Go forward with our third case of the day, TD Bank versus Vernon Hill. TD Bank.
Good morning, Your Honors. Howard Hogan from Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher here for appellant. Vernon Hill with me is Ariana Scavetti of my firm. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
May it please the court. This case is about an order that bans the distribution of a book and has been interpreted by the district court and TD Bank to gag my client from speaking about that book on the basis of a record that is devoid of legally competent evidence that my client ever gave up the right to tell his philosophy and his life story publicly. Much like in this court's decision in Brownstein versus Lindsay, the court simply made fundamental errors on issues of joint ownership.
Well, let me ask something before we get started here, because I think I'm in the wrong court. This is on an interlocutory appeal. On an interlocutory appeals, we do not hear the merits of the case. We hear what the appeal was granted for was not whether the merits were correct or not. It was whether or not the interlocutory order should have been granted per injunction. So why do we have to involve with who owns it, whether they own it or he owns it or the joint owner or whatever? Why don't we just deal with whether or not they were entitled to a permanent injunction?
Respectfully, Your Honor, as this court found when sitting en banc in the Board of Trustees of the University of Medicine and Dentistry case, when the court below issues an injunction, the merits that underlie that injunction are inextricably intertwined. That's not my lawyer gloss. That's the actual language from the case.
You have to look at the case to see whether it's inextricably involved. And if it's not part of the appeal.
That's right. But the only way you can enjoin a book or a copyright, an item that allegedly infringes a copyright, is if it actually infringes. That's why it's inextricably intertwined. In fact, in the Dijon versus Temple University case, this court found that it's frequent in hearing an appeal of an injunction to address the merits.
Well, I misread your brief then. I went over my head because I understood your position to be that regardless of who owns this work, they didn't qualify under the law to receive an injunction.
That is our position.
You didn't care whether or not who owns it, or do you own it jointly, they own it, or who owns it, that they weren't entitled under the law to an injunction.
Yes. Well, we wouldn't be the first lawyers before Your Honor to be arguing that we win under different theories. We do strongly believe that under the court's jurisprudence in eBay versus Merck Exchange and in subsequent cases, that the TD, because TD Bank has not shown any harm,
any
other
damages,
elements,
that
they're not entitled. But right. They also lose because they do not have the property right that they're seeking to enforce. Or at least they don't have the exclusive property right, because we assert that it's a joint authorship situation.
Your client signed a guarantee. And signed a performance agreement, I believe it was called.
No, respectfully, Your Honor, my client didn't sign a. It's what's referred to there's a document called a guarantee, which was my client
but
signed.
But that document referred to another,
exactly,
a separate document, in which he ceded essentially his right to the book to his Commerce Bank, perhaps initially, and that right was acquired by TD Bank.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. There's two documents. But there's the guarantee agreement that Mr. Hill signed, which said, I have an interest in the author and in having the work published. And it referenced a separate agreement that Commerce signed with the publisher that would have led to the publication of the book. But neither of these would have been legally sufficient.
He agreed that it was a work for hire and Commerce Bank is the author. Is that right?
Yes, after saying that he had an interest in the author.
Are you saying it's an assignment?
No, respectfully, Judge Cowan, it doesn't make it an assignment.
They say, I'm not saying it's an assignment. That's their position, as I understand it.
No, as a matter of fact, they affirmatively said that the guarantee is not an assignment three times in the record. First at Joint Appendix 1307, which the court pointed to in the letter that you sent us last week. They had a request for admission, and they affirmatively said the guarantee is not an assignment. Secondarily, at Joint Appendix 1388, the statement of uncontested facts that TD Bank submitted to oppose my client's motion for summary judgment, they again said they admitted that there was no assignment language in the guarantee. And third, we took the deposition of TD Bank's representative under Rule 30b-6 on the meaning of the guarantee, and in that deposition, Mr. Fisher affirmatively testified that the meaning of the guarantee was the book is coming, I will make sure that it gets written, the publisher doesn't have anything to worry about.
I suppose your argument now, therefore, is he can't be enjoined from publishing his own book?
That's right.
And if we disagree? As to ownership?
Then we still think that the case needs to be remanded for fact-finding on the infringement issues. This is a very unusual case, Your Honors. It's unusual because the accused is admittedly the author of the work being asserted. It is unusual because TD Bank admits that 84% of the accused book is totally non-infringing. It is unusual because the remaining 16% is still very much a factual issue. On reply for summary judgment, TD Bank offered a computer comparison of the two books with no expert testimony, no deposition testimony about it. And we believe that even when it comes to that remaining 16%, it's made up of common terminology, sans affaire, things that can only be said so many ways. These are anecdotes from Mr. Hill's life, his philosophy that he's repeated hundreds of times.
Could you comment, while time is running, on the eBay factors as they apply to your case?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no question that this case cannot stand in light of eBay. eBay was crystal clear. The Supreme Court said that if the plaintiff cannot establish that it's been harmed and that the balance of factors favor an injunction and the other eBay factors, then an injunction should not issue. This is as clear a case as you could find.
What do you say about irreparable harm?
The only irreparable harm that either the district court or TD Bank has pointed to is the loss of exclusive control of a book that they don't even use. They let sit and gather dust for years. They do not make commercial use.
In that context, there's no harm, no irreparable harm?
There's no harm, period.
The district court cited eBay in this decision. It applied it, did it?
It cited eBay versus Mark Exchange for the factors, and it mechanically worked through the factors, but it ignored the part of the decision that said you don't get a presumption of harm just because you have a copyright. You have to actually show that you're being harmed. And here, there couldn't be a clearer case that they're not being harmed because the work is something they don't use at all. They're not in the book business. They're a bank.
Counsel, do we have any live issue as to the propriety of an injunction without making a threshold determination about the summary judgment order on copyright ownership?
If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, asking whether this is a moot, whether the case is now moot, is that?
Well, it's really whether any decision about injunctive relief would be hypothetical or conditional without us making a threshold evaluation of the summary judgment order on ownership.
Thank you, Your Honor. We believe that it is The parties to this case have a long and tortured history. There's no secret about that. And we believe that if the court simply remands on the eBay factors, it's very likely we will be back before your honors at some future time to deal with the summary judgment issue. However, in this case, the record is quite clear that TD Bank does not have the kind of legally cognizable evidence that would defeat my client's co-ownership claim right now based on the existing record. So it's not a two-way door. If this court remands, then there will be fact findings on the ownership and the infringement issues. However, there's sufficient record today to affirm.
How do you get co-ownership? Where does that come from?
It's a common concept in copyright law. In fact, in CCNV versus Reed, the case that is the controlling case from the Supreme Court on work made for hire, Justice Marshall suggested in dicta, of course, that maybe the right result in that case would have been co-ownership. In this case, Mr. Hill worked with TD Bank to tell his story, his philosophy.
Do you mean Commerce Bank?
No, excuse me. It was Commerce Bank at the time. Yes, Your Honor. As a win-win, it would promote the bank and it would allow Mr. Hill to tell his story.
So it's from the relationship of Mr. Hill with Commerce Bank that you can infer that he has co-ownership rights?
No, as a matter of black letter law, Your Honor, the act of being an author gives you rights. You only lose rights if you're stripped of them. There's only one of two ways to do it. Either it can be stripped as a work made for hire or as an assignment. Earlier, I explained.
I do know that Commerce Bank signed an agreement with a publisher that identified Commerce Bank as the sole owner of this work.
Well, respectfully, a document that's only signed by Commerce Bank can't strip Mr. Hill of his rights.
Yeah, but he acknowledged that the 2007 manuscript is a work for hire and Commerce Bank is the author.
And as Mr. Hill repeatedly testified, that work for hire language was a reference to the co-author, Bob Andelman, who was hired to help him write the book.
He also guarantees that the author has full power and authority to enter into the agreement.
And he also said, and I have an interest in the author.
An interest in the author is different than having an interest in the work, right, as a co-author.
Well, it's at best ambiguous, but the important point is under 17 U.S.C. 204A, it can only be construed as an assignment if it clearly assigns his right. It clearly transfers his rights. That document does not transfer rights, and TD Bank has admitted that it didn't. The only other way is if it was ab initio, a work made for hire. This is the point of the section of the Nimmer Treatise that was cited in the letter that Your Honor sent to us. There are there's larger significance if it is treated as an assignment versus it's treated as a work made for hire.
At some point. Yeah, at some point I'd like to hear you address the eBay factors. If I were to disagree with you with respect to the issue of ownership, I know your time is run, but
you're on our time.
Okay.
as will be your counterpart.
Well, it's an interesting ownership of this. Although I'm very concerned, your own client said that we work for 24/7, so I'm a company man or whatever. But why do we have to get into that? There's no final order here. The only reason, as I previously mentioned, is for the interlocutory appeal. If we hold that the eBay factors were not satisfied, although the district court cited it, he didn't apply them, there's no damages here, except maybe statutory damages, I guess. and we could just deny that and send you back to determine what's going to be the final order in this case. And then this panel or some other panel will deal with it down the road. But why do we even have to deal with that when we don't have to pay any? I never pay more for anything I buy than I need to. We don't have to pay anything more than just say the eBay factor was not, according to your briefing, not satisfied because they have suffered no damages. And the injunction is, even if they're right as a matter of law, they are not entitled to an injunction.
Thank you.
You don't disagree with it.
No, I do not disagree with you that they have not satisfied the eBay factor. So the case can be reversed on that basis alone. I do think as a matter of judicial economy, as a matter of following the guidance that this court in Bonk has given, that the court should address the underlying infringement issues.
But is there any reason for us to even weigh the eBay factors? Do we reach the question of the application of the eBay factors if we conclude that your client did not, one way or the other, relinquish ownership rights. If he retained those rights, then there couldn't be infringement, and therefore any injunction would be per se unreasonable, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
And so there would be no reason for us to even weigh into the eBay factors.
That is correct.
So we only reach the eBay factors if we take on the hypothetical assumption of ownership having been transferred one way or the other.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
So with that in mind, if that is an issue that we ultimately determine we need to grapple with, I'd like to understand your approach on work for hire, and we will certainly address to the eBay factors. Okay. But on work for hire, the factors include time and space boundaries. And I'd like your thoughts on how much weight those things should carry when we're talking about senior executives in a corporation, and we're talking about the internet age where people are working remotely and 24/7 through their devices.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will get back to Judge Fuentes' question about the eBay factors, but to address the work for hire factors, there are two methods by which a work for hire can arise. One is an independent contractor, and if this is all set forth in the definition of work made for hire under 17 U.S.C. 101, gives the two ways a work for hire can be created. The independent contractor route is explicitly limited to very narrow situations: translations, motion pictures, compilations. And TD Bank has admitted none of those situations apply. They did it in the Rule 56 statement of material undisputed facts. So that is off the table. So the only way this could have been a work made for hire under the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in CCNV versus Reed is if this was in this task of writing this book was within the scope of his employment. It's not just whether he was an employee, it's whether this work was in the scope of his employment. And the fact remains that they have no proof that it was within the scope of Mr. Hill's employment to write a book for the bank.
But it was within the scope of his employment to market the bank and to increase the customer base. And there are several indications that that was at least one of the purposes of the work.
Yes, but it doesn't follow that it must be exclusively owned by the bank, because he was telling his story, his philosophy. He was putting himself out there. It's his wife, his dog in the book. The whole story is personal to him. He could be motivated by wanting to help market the bank, but he was going beyond that. The only evidence in the record is that when CEOs write books about their philosophy, they tend to retain the ownership rights in the book, because writing a book is a different activity. It may have incidental benefits to the bank, but it does not strip Mr. Hill of his right to tell his own life story.
Does it matter that he concedes or admits that it is a work for hire?
He does not concede that it was a work for hire as applied to his life story. He testified repeatedly that it was a work made for hire by his co-author, Robert Andelman.
I have a note that he acknowledged the 2007 manuscript is a work for hire and Commerce Bank is the author. Do I have that wrong?
In the guarantee document, the one we had been talking about, he says, I have an interest in the author and in having the book published. And I acknowledge it's a work made for hire, but it doesn't say my work is a work made for hire. It just says it's a work made for hire. And he had a co-author who was writing the book with him, who was hired to write the book.
Is it work for hire was referring to some other book?
No, it's referring to this book, but the contribution of his co-author, Robert Andelman. It does not transfer, certainly not unambiguously, but not even on ambiguously does it transfer his rights to his underlying stories that he's told over and over again.
He states in the guarantee, I unconditionally guarantee that the work, the defined term work, is a work made for hire. Not that Mr. Andelman's portion of the work, or that which doesn't relate to his own personal philosophy, is is a work for hire. It's the work in total that he's guaranteeing is a work for hire. How is that not, yeah, I mean, even if we accept that you can't deem something to be a work for hire, given that statement, the reference to the author, that is the bank, as the singular owner of the copyright, and the assurance that the bank had full power and authority to enter into the publisher agreement, how is that not an unambiguous transfer of ownership assignment?
It's not an unambiguous transfer because on 17 U.S.C. 204A, it has to explicitly say I'm transferring my rights, and it just doesn't say that.
How does the statute require those magic words?
There are no magic words, but it has to be clear what is being assigned. The whole point of Section 204A is so that somebody is not inadvertently stripped of their rights. And fundamentally, what we're talking about here is his right to tell his stories from his own life. It would be contrary to the text of Section 204A to read a statement about a work made for hire generally, A, not only to create a transfer where it doesn't say I'm transferring my rights, but B, to then use that to fill in holes to strip him of his rights that are built into the protection of the work made for hire provisions of the Copyright Act.
It's based on the bank's agreement with a publisher. Do you agree or disagree that Commerce Bank could have submitted the text for copyright purposes and could have sold the book?
I agree that they could have sold the book that they could have registered the copyright, as they in fact did. But
that would have been inconsistent, of course, with Mr. Hill's position.
Not necessarily. Mr. Hill filed an adverse application to register that he was the co-author of the book. The premise of copyright law is that when you're a joint author, both, it's like joint tenants in common. Both have an unfettered right to exploit the property. There may be situations where one has a claim against another over profits based on the work, but both parties to a joint ownership of a copyright have an unfettered right.
I thought the law on copyright was that a co-owner could not unilaterally grant an exclusive license, for example.
There are lines of cases about exclusivity, but it is black letter law that both sides can exploit the right. So if I don't have an exclusive right, I can't confer an exclusive right. If I'm a joint owner and we both have a right to license, we can each license the work. We just can't say to a third party, you have an exclusive right, because my co-author can also license that right.
It's your position that the guarantee that the bank had the full power and authority to enter into the publishing agreement is not inconsistent with co-ownership?
It is not inconsistent with co-ownership because Mr. Hill was guaranteeing he would create the work. He would actually make sure the book got written. At the time it was signed in 2006, the book didn't exist. He was simply telling the publisher, I'm going to make sure that this gets written and that we'll be able to publish it.
But you're representing to us, as you understand copyright law, that the bank would have full power and authority to enter into the publishing agreement without having agreement to do so, or relinquishment of copyright rights of a co-owner of the copyright.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's a little awkward because the book didn't exist when these documents were signed. That's the reason for the guarantee. If the book had been written and they were co-authors and co-owners, then the bank could have an absolute right to allow the publisher to publish the book with or without Mr. Hill's permission.
But you don't concede that they're co-owners. You're the only owner.
No, Your Honor. We don't take the position that Mr. Hill is the only owner.
Your position is they're co-owners with you.
Yes.
Well, once Commerce Bank copyrights this text, Mr. Hill is out, isn't he? I mean, he's done. It's no longer his work.
Respectfully, Your Honor, TD Bank did not even try to register the copyright till after Mr. Hill's book was out.
That's really what I was asking. I mean, once they go enter into a copyright the text and enter into a publishing deal, Mr. Hill is out of the picture.
I may not be understanding, Your Honor.
I mean, maybe I'm not understanding you. I mean, when you say they're co-owners, and yet Commerce Bank has these rights where they can copyright the book. Now it's theirs, and they can market it. They can enter into publishing deals with major publishers. Where does your client stand with respect to that book?
He has a similar unfettered right to exploit the work as a co-author. They can publish it, he can publish it. They can create derivative works, he can create
derivative. That's what you mean by co-ownership and
yes.
Co-copyright rights?
Yes. It's like being a joint owner, a joint tenant in common. You have unfettered right to exploit the piece of property.
Yeah, but the district court held that you have no ownership in it.
That's right.
That you gave an assignment of assignment.
That's right. The district court issued a finding of fact contrary to the non-moving party, my client, Mr. Hill, on that factual
claim. His statement that Commerce Bank is the author and has a right to seek copyright rights, your interpretation is, well, I'm just giving them part of the rights. I retain the same rights.
Yes, that he was retaining his right as co-owner, as an interest in the author.
Okay.
That was his understanding of the agreement. And under the clear copyright case law, that's not enough to transfer his right away. So we're back to the whether ab initio it could have become TD Rights property to because he was an employee and worked with them to tell his story, whether he was could have given up those rights. And that only happens if writing the book is within the scope of his employment.
He did write another book, but he didn't write the same thing, did he?
No, his 2012 book is they concede 84% new and original and different, non-protectable in any event.
Well, there's no final order from the district court, but then is it your position that the district court has closed the book insofar as who's the owner of this and that you're the co-owner with them, and that's where the district court is going to leave it until the final order is actually put in place?
No, Your Honor. The way the district court left it is TD Bank owns his life story and has an order in place that TD Bank says is infringed anytime he speaks about it.
That's right. They say that the bank owns it. You don't have any ownership in it, not even co-ownership, because it was assigned to them.
That's right.
Okay. And you want us to reverse that order based on the law that it doesn't qualify as an assignment of work for, you know.
Exactly, that there's only two ways it could be TD's property, work made for hire or assignment, and they don't fit either statutory definition.
If we disagree with you that Mr. Hill is a co-owner of the text?
It's at least an issue of fact that should be remanded, but we would then ask you to consider the eBay factors, because here it is as clear a case as one can imagine. That TD Bank concedes it's not being harmed. It's not competing with Mr. Hill in the book business. It have never used this piece of property. There is still a damages issue. Here they're unhappy with the damages issue because Mr. Hill hasn't made any money on the book, but that may have something to do with the fact that TD Bank's lawyers wrote to every bookseller in the world and told them to stop selling the book.
I thought TD Bank was not interested at all in having this book marketed.
They are not, as far as I can tell.
And they have damages.
They have preserved a claim to disgorge Mr. Hill's profits. But they waived their right to pursue actual damages, harm to TD Bank. They affirmatively waived it.
In any case, we're talking about irreparable damages.
Yes.
If there were damages, those damages can be repaired.
They're both interrelated because the availability of money damages is one of the factors, right. The eBay factors that we have to consider. So,
what about the right not to speak? Did eBay really foreclose a right to injunctive relief when the holder of intellectual property has decided not to use it? I mean, it does, as the district court pointed out, rely on Continental. And we have the Second Circuit in Salinger pointing out that the First Amendment includes a right not to speak, and that infringement of that is irreparable harm.
Well, in that Salinger case, the court reversed an injunction. They found that there was no showing of harm. And the case subsequently settled, so there's no finding of fact. There may be a First Amendment interest in not speaking, but if there, this is not that case. It simply is not. It's Mr. Hill's own life story. It is a reflection of his philosophy. It is things he said in a Harvard business study, as the district court noticed. It is things that he, anecdotes he told. One of the stories is an anecdote about Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, who Mr. Hill worked with in his youth. These are fundamental parts of Mr. Hill's life, not TD Bank's life. The Constitution...
The infringement does not go to his life story per se, right? The infringement goes to those portions that take verbatim text, if we assume that ownership rests with the bank. And Mr. Hill was able, within a few weeks, to go on and excise those portions to write a book that apparently is certainly less of a concern in terms of infringement. So the order of injunction was not to ever speak about any of it. It was only as to the infringing portions, which have now been excised in a 2016 book, right?
There is a 2016 book. A few points, Your Honor, on that. One, TD Bank has as narrowly drawn as possible its concession that the 2016 book does not infringe. They limit their statement to the Kindle version, not the print version, which is, by the way, not available in the United States because booksellers are afraid to sell it because of this injunction. And so the fact that the injunction is hanging over this book is impeding the distribution of the book in the United States.
Would foreign entities' misunderstanding of our law, if that's what it was,
no, Your Honor,
really be a basis to conclude that there was still a live issue as to the 2012 book? Or do we need to hear from you that there is an intent on your client's part to continue to distribute the 2012 book itself?
Just to clarify, I was not talking about foreign entities. I'm talking about the fact the book is available for sale in England, but in the United States, booksellers are not willing to sell, apparently, the print book. TD Bank and its supplemental appendix put in lots of images of offers of the book for sale, and conspicuously, none of them offer to sell the physical book in the United States of America. It's British pounds and things like that. And so one of the reasons the case is not moot and that we need to have the injunction lifted is that it is impairing his ability to sell even his rewritten 2016 book. Above and beyond that, the court and TD Bank have interpreted the order such that if Mr. Hill speaks about the book publicly, he's threatened with a contempt finding.
Is that what the injunction would do for you? I mean, if the injunction were dissolved, you can just go right out and sell the book?
Well, it's a unique fact circumstance because Mr. Hill doesn't actually sell the book. Mr. Hill wrote the book, a publisher printed it, and sold copies to book distributors who are third parties. And yet, as late as TD Bank's merits brief at footnote 12, they still accuse Mr. Hill of violating the original injunction because the original 2012 book was available for sale on Amazon.
What about the eBay factor of balance of harms? Isn't the fact that Mr. Hill was able to so quickly rewrite the book, and to the extent there may still be problems with certain portions of it, their targeted portions, doesn't that indicate balance of harm is not in his favor?
I understand your Honor's question, but I respectfully disagree. On one side of a balance, there has to be some harm to TD Bank. Here, there's simply no harm. This is not something that they use commercially, that they sell, that they have any harm to reputation, even though harm to reputation is not properly part of the copyright analysis. There is no harm, zero harm. The only harm is the loss of exclusive control. And that is exactly what eBay versus Merck Exchange said is not enough to justify an injunction. Maybe if they had a Salinger-like showing of some kind, I'm going to be psychically scarred if this stuff's out, maybe they would have something to balance on the side of TD Bank, but they don't. There's just nothing. There's an absolute absence of the record.
Do you know if TD Bank is referred to? I mean, it was written while he, based on his, apparently his tenure as president of Commerce Bank, not during his period with TD Bank, which I understand was very brief. Do you know if TD Bank is referred to in the book?
Not once. Neither in the 2007 manuscript, nor the 2012, nor the 2016 editions of Mr.
Well, it doesn't appear that they would suffer any harm, either reputational or otherwise, if that book were published.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Is there no value at all in the eBay analysis of a right not to speak? And to the extent that that's also part of at least a First Amendment right, I understand your argument that that right to exclusivity is not one that can, on its own, can drive an injunction after eBay. But as we're weighing the various eBay factors, doesn't it at least come into play in terms of public interest?
Well, two responses, Your Honor. One, this court does not need to find that there is no legitimate interest in not speaking. It's just that in this case, there's no part of the record that supports that at all. That would be the kind of thing that the Second Circuit talked about in dicta in the Salinger case, where somebody has their personal identity in not having something out there. There's nothing like that in the record, nothing whatsoever. But on the public interest side, we concede that there's a public interest in enforcing copyright laws, but that, again, is what eBay and versus Mark Exchange said is not enough in a case where there's no harm to the IP owner. In that case, it was a patent case, although the court did speak of copyright in dicta in that same case. The clearer statement is that there's public interest in free and full discussion. And we're talking about a book. We're not talking about any of the hundreds of cases that TD Bank cites where there's knockoff products and misuse of photographs to sell illegitimate or unaffiliated products or any of that. TD Bank does not cite to a single post-eBay versus Mark Exchange case granting or affirming an injunction where, as here, they were not using the IP right asserted at all.
But it does affect their right to use it in the future and derive the same value.
Again, that would be theoretical, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that would indicate that they want to. In fact, we asked their 30B6 witness whether they had any intent to ever use it again, and that he said no. There were written discovery on this point. They have no intent to ever use this document again. I don't know what my adversary will say when he gets up, but I doubt there is any plan by TD Bank to ever use this.
You were in a district court proceeding. Was there ever disclosed any basis for wanting to suppress this text at all by any of the two banks? TD Bank? Is there something in there that's just horrible, terrible?
No, Your Honor. As a matter of fact,
was it disclosed in the district court, or is it just that we're the owners and we have ownership rights and we don't want you to publish this book? Was that the essence of it?
That is the essence of it, and it's even worse than that, Your Honor, because TD Bank attached the full manuscript that they were protecting to their complaint. The American Banker magazine had been running excerpts of Mr. Hill's book. This is all in the record. They had been running excerpts of Mr. Hill's book, and after TD Bank's lawyer sent them a letter, they took down the excerpts of Mr. Hill's book in its entirety and have left it unused. But what they did do, they put a link up and they said, if you want to read the manuscript, here's a link. And they left it up for years. TD Bank never went to the American Banker magazine and said, please take down the manuscript. It harms us for it to be out there.
But in this record, there was no disclosure as to any rationale for wanting to keep this book from being publicized, made public.
The only rationale that was expressed either by the court or TD Bank is the desire to prevent unauthorized use of what they think is their property.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Tambusi, you can anticipate you will not be limited to your time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Good morning still. Thank you. Please the court, William M. Tambusi, Brown and Connery, for the plaintiff TD Bank in this case. At the outset, TD Bank acquired Commerce Bank and its assets in October 2007. Included in those assets was the 2007 manuscript, which is the subject of this litigation. And let's make no mistake about this. This was not an autobiography. It was a marketing tool. When published, it was to come with a $25 coupon to open an account at Commerce Bank.
It also had a dedication to his family members.
It did, but it didn't have the picture of Mr. Hill or any of his family members on the cover of the book.
The majority of the book was about him, though, wasn't it?
It was not. It was about different things. It was about Commerce Bank. And in fact, the portfolio contract and Mr. Hill's testimony said that the book was about Commerce Bank. He conceded it. And it was about Commerce Bank, and it was about the model, including America's most convenient bank. If you walk by a TD Bank today, you'll still see the catchphrase, America's most convenient bank.
It's like which good was, propaganda.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Good propaganda for TD Bank.
Here's the thing. It would
I'm trying to get to what?
It would be good propaganda if TD Bank wanted to continue its association with Mr. Hill, which it did not for a variety of reasons.
Problem what he says in the book, or is it a problem with Mr. Hill?
It's a problem with Mr. Hill in particular.
A problem with what's in the book.
Because the book itself associates itself with Mr. Hill. And as Judge Kugler recognized and specifically said in his opinion, one reading this book would have no doubt, that it was the same book, the same manuscript. But the manuscript as written by Mr. Hill in 2007 was in fact a book to promote Commerce Bank. When TD took over Commerce Bank and acquired all the assets, it had the right to market itself and to speak of itself in the manner it saw fit. And that included the use of the 2007 manuscript or not. Now, Mr. Hill, as CEO of Commerce Bank, could have very easily, like many CEOs do, reserved the right to retain some ownership interest in this manuscript. He did not. Mr. Hill instead signed a document confirming that it was a work made for hire that was integrated into the portfolio contract.
But you agree it's error to use the party's stipulation that something is a work for hire if the work in fact does not meet the criteria of being a work for hire.
But the work did meet the criteria of work made for hire.
The district court didn't go through those agency factors. The district court didn't do that analysis.
A statutory requirement of a work for hire or an assignment for that matter.
Let's go through the work made for hire. Mr. Hill himself conceded and testified that his work was 24/7 for Commerce Bank.
How we all say that?
Well, Mr. Hill meant it because he did it, Judge. He really did.
Well, I'm sure he did, but that's a coin that everyone
Mr. Hill
is totally dedicated to their job.
Mr. Hill continued, Judge, through his deposition testifying, and it was before the court, the testimony of Mr. Hill, that he had worked on weekends, on Saturdays, on Sundays, at different hours, day and night, calling his senior executives, bringing them in to talk about bank openings and the like, store openings, he calls them. Mr. Hill worked from his home. He had numerous events at his home. Mr. Hill truly, truly exhibited the fact that he worked 24/7.
Well, that may present reasons why the traditional factors of time and location have less bearing in the context of a corporate executive and in the times in which we live where people are working remotely and after hours. But how does that go to, if you're taking your argument on its face, it would mean that an executive who wrote fiction nights and weekends would have relegated that to work for hire status because they were working 24/7 for the corporate entity.
Except, Judge, we have an admission by Mr. Hill in writing. But it's a writing.
Again, under Nimmer, under Goldstein, under copyright law, you can't be stipulating to something constituting a work for hire. It has to meet the criteria for work for hire. And I take it you're not arguing that this meets any of the 9 categories of work for hire in Section 101 of the Copyright Act, right?
Correct, Judge. What we're saying is that what the district court had before was Mr. Hill's testimony, his deposition testimony. What the district court had before was Mr. Hill's guarantee, whether you call it a guarantee or anything else, where Mr. Hill, a sophisticated businessman, a Wharton School graduate, signed a document that he testified to was integrated with his publishing contract. And in that document, he expresses his clear intent that the intent being that the work that was done to promote Commerce Bank belonged to Commerce Bank.
Well, insofar as the publisher is concerned, he's guaranteeing that to the publisher, but is he guaranteeing that to the bank?
He is.
Well, you could say he is, but the reason he signed it was to get it published. It was not to assign his right in a work to the bank.
Judge, what it is
if we're going over, to have an assignment, you have to have an assignment of what you're assigning. And they didn't need, that document is not an assignment to the bank.
The document clearly makes reference to what Mr. Hill's intent was, which was that, in fact, the bank owned the work.
Well, his intent was to get it published. It was not to, you can't from that extrapolate that it's, his intent is to assign his interest in the work to the bank.
We had a work that was paid for by the bank. We had a work that had a co-author that was paid for by the bank. We had a work where bank executives were called at different hours of the day and night to offer additional stories and anecdotes about the bank, the formation of the bank. Mr. Hill signed a document, clear on its face, a writing signed by the owner of rights, assuming that had rights, individual rights, to suffer from a work made for hire.
Does all of that qualify this book as a work made for hire?
I think all the facts before the district court qualify this as a work made for hire. For sure. I think that if the court were to take the position that it's not a work made for hire.
Apart and apart from his admission.
If the court were to take the position that this were not a work made for hire.
No.
But
what of the all the things that you say, what makes this qualify statutorily as a work made for hire?
Mr. Hill worked on the book during working hours. Mr. Hill worked on the book exclusively at the expense of Commerce Bank. Mr. Hill worked on the book using Commerce Bank resources. Mr. Hill worked on the book in furtherance of Commerce Bank.
Yeah, but that was not his job as such. That was not something was within the scope, was did his duties of office require him to write the book or whatever, you know. His job is to be president or whatever of a bank. It's not to write a book.
His duties were to market and advance the goals of the bank. That's what was set forth in his employment agreement.
Did he discuss the operation of the bank and the many facets of Commerce Bank and things like that?
He discussed the philosophy of the bank. He discussed the America's Most Convenient Bank. He discussed the opening of stores. He discussed the location of stores throughout the book.
Well, at the very least, though, don't you have a question of fact at the very bottom of it?
In terms of whether or not, it doesn't make a difference, though, at the end, because whether or not this is a work made for a hire or it was a work that Mr. Hill assigned to the bank, the ownership still resides in the bank. And once we get to that point, Mr. Hill's use of those words that he was able to transform in 2016 without problem to another work leads us to the same conclusion.
To the extent we need to reach a question about assignment, either because we aren't persuaded it's a work for hire, or it's not something, given that the district court did not weigh those agency factors, that we choose to take on in the first instance. What do we do with the fact that assignment is not an argument that you made either in the district court or in your brief on appeal?
Respectfully, Judge, I'm primarily a trial lawyer. And as a trial lawyer at the summary judgment stage, I'm making a motion and I'm going to argue the facts that are most significant to me. When you look at when you make those significant to my side's argument, when you make those arguments, you must look at all the evidence that we present before the case. But we don't waive the right to make other arguments at trial should summary judgment be denied. If you look at the request for admission in particular, the request for admission specifically says, admitted to the extent that the guarantee is not an assignment. We didn't waive the right to argue that the guarantee was not an assignment. Our position on the motion for summary judgment was and remains that it was a work made for hire. We, in the alternative, preserved our right to raise at trial the issue of whether or not the guarantee was an assignment. So we didn't waive the issue at the district court in its entirety. What we did was we argued to our strength, what we believe our strength to be. Now, if the court believes that it was not a work made for hire, it still can't ignore the clear intent expressed by Mr. Hill in the guarantee. That being said, we reached the same conclusion. Mr. Hill was a serial violator of Commerce Bank's copyrighted material. This was not the first time he was before the district court on a violation of a copyright owned by Commerce Bank.
Well, we're only dealing with this case. On the assignment basis, generally you think of an assignment being an assignment from A to B. A, I'm going to assign you something. You don't think of B saying, I got to sign something because A said something to C that belongs to B or something like that. You think of an assignment of rights being a direct assignment of giving up something to a person. Not that I said to C something and B now claims they're a beneficiary of what I said to C.
Judge, we believe the argument that addresses that question or that comment is contained in the very last sentence of the guarantee. It says, the owner, Mr. Hill, hereby waives notice of the acceptance of this guarantee. Mr. Hill knew the broad scope of this guarantee. Mr. Hill expressed his intent in this guarantee.
He didn't guarantee that to the bank.
Mr. Hill acknowledged that he had an interest in the bank, no doubt about it. And Mr. Hill acknowledged under oath, specifically from my questioning, that the agreements were integrated. Mr. Hill acknowledged that he read the agreements. He's not an unsophisticated user.
But no. Judge Cowan is asking a question. I share an interest in what do we do with the fact that this is not, if it's to be viewed as an assignment, it's not an agreement that's actually with the bank.
But it's integrated with the agreement with the bank. The words would have no meaning because the terms are common. The capital W works is defined in the portfolio contract.
What is your authority that there can be a contract to transfer or an assignment that would qualify under Section 204 of the Copyright Act that would not be with the party, the beneficiary, to whom those copyrights are assigned?
Our argument, Judge, is that the document itself is integrated with the portfolio contract. It's one document. And Mr. Hill, having an ownership interest in the author, knew of that document, admitted that, and conceded it, and it expressed his intent in a clear, unambiguous writing as required by rule, Section 204.
Do you have any case law for us that an assignment would be effective if that writing is not directly with the beneficiary of the copyright of the transfer?
We don't have any citation directly, Judge, but we can cite to the Brewster decision, which says the nature of the obligation depends on the party's intention. And where the intention may be gathered from the four corners of the instrument, interpretation of the contract is a question of law. The four corners of this contract here is the portfolio contract with the guarantee. It's one document. It's an integrated document.
Yeah, but what the question is, what was the intent when he signed that? Was it, in other words, in order to assign something, you have to intend to give the person you're assigning it your rights. Can you read that and say that by guaranteeing this, because I want this thing published, that I'm also at the same time intend to give to the company my interest if I have any in this writing?
Well, again, we believe this is clearly a work made for hire, and Judge Kugler addressed that sufficiently in the record. But even if it is,
I'm having a lot of trouble with the work for that's a, it's a work for hire, but that's okay.
But even if it isn't. Even if it isn't a work made for hire,
yeah.
Mr. Hill's intent is expressed clearly through the words of the guarantee, words that he acknowledged that he read, words that he as a sophisticated business person understands, and words that he admitted were integrated into the portfolio contract.
But as your adversary has pointed out, those words include that he has an interest in the offer. Why doesn't that preserve his interest?
What Mr. Hill did is he signed over his interest to Commerce Bank by the guarantee or assignment, whatever name is ascribed to that document. That was his intent. He signed that over. There is no document whereby Mr. Hill retained any ownership interest in the work, 2007 manuscript. There is no document whereby Mr. Hill claims to be a co-author of the 2007 manuscript. Yeah. This is not an autobiography. This is a marketing tool and a story about a bank.
Okay.
And Mr. Hill was able, within weeks of the entry of the injunction, to write a 2016 version of this book, to which, if he certifies, as was the case in Faring versus Watson, that he would not publish the 2012 manuscript or book or distribute it or otherwise market it, this case would be over.
Do you concede that the 2016 book contains no infringing material? Is that your position?
Our position is that the Kindle version of the 2016 book, which is the only version we've been able to obtain, we have not been able to obtain it from trying to purchase it in London. We have not been able to obtain it from Mr. Hill through his counsel. Our position is that if that version, the print version of the 2016 version, is the same as the 2016 version of the Kindle version, and Mr. Hill certifies that he will not market, distribute, publish, or otherwise distribute the 2012 version, the case is over.
What about? I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Finish.
In your motion to supplement the record, you represent not only that the 2016 edition is out there, but you also say that the 2012 book has also been made available to the sale again, to the public for sale again, and that the revised book and original book are both currently available to the public for sale. How under those circumstances would this be a moot case if you still take issue with the 2012 book being disseminated?
We take issue with the 2012 book being disseminated. It's moot because we do not take issue with the Kindle version, which is the only version we've seen, of the 2016 rewrite.
I thought you said it wasn't available.
It's available on Kindle. We have never been able to get or obtain a hard copy, no matter how many times we've asked, no matter whom we've asked.
Okay. Assume you're, for the purpose of argument, assume you're right. You own it and they don't. You got an injunction, and under the law as presently stands, you have not, and you didn't put forth any damages that you needed an injunction to protect you from irreparable harm. So even if you're right, why do we have to get into that? We could actually end this case by saying that you're not entitled to any injunctive relief.
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. First of all, in the context of this case, we did not obtain the injunction immediately upon the ruling that there was an infringement on summary judgment. We asked for it. It was denied. It wasn't until after subsequent acts that we made an application, and it wasn't granted until almost a year, 352 days.
That's when the revised book was distributed?
That's when the 2012 book was distributed, despite the finding that there was a copyright infringement. This case is the rule of law and the fundamental respect for the district court's ruling as anything else. But directly to your question, Judge, as to the damages, this isn't just exercising our right to control the publication, which is a right that TD Bank has. What it's also about is TD Bank's First Amendment right, not distribute or market
Judge
that.
Judge Cowan is mentioning eBay factors, and there are factors you have to go to, and the first one has to do with irreparable harm. How do you suffer irreparable harm if your harm can actually be compensated by money damages or a percentage of the books distributed, let's say?
In this case, again, we have to turn on a unique set of facts. Mr. Hill is a very wealthy man. He can manipulate whether or not there's lost profits or not.
You can tap into his vast wealth to compensate you for your harm.
But by buying books himself increasing the expenses on those books and then giving those books out, he's not going to create a loss.
Okay, why is your harm irreparable?
But there's irreparable harm because we have TD Bank has a First Amendment right in the book. That's in Salinger. And clearly the First Amendment right, along with the right to have exclusive control of the book, is irreparable harm. Because if it's not, then we don't have a property right in a copyright.
What's your First Amendment right that's being violated by them infringing on your copyright?
We have the right to market ourselves, portray ourselves, and to express ourselves in our own way and manner in which we decide.
No one's denying you that right. They're just publishing your work. They're not denying you to do any of those things with your book.
Does it matter that he's not talking about TD Bank?
It's our right to decide to market ourselves. Clearly, it's our right. By Mr. Hill taking a book that infringes on our property, he is controlling the marketing. Now, Mr. Hill himself, Judge, I think this will address your question, didn't withdraw from the banking business. He's still in the banking business in New Jersey. He's still in the banking business marketing, promoting his new bank, much in the same way he promoted the Commerce Bank model.
Well, what's that to do with your irreparable harm, though? If he's in a new bank and do whatever he can do for the new bank.
I was addressing Judge Fuente's question on whether or not we were in any competition where he was speaking about us, whatever. But what it has to do with our irreparable harm is that we have the right to control our message, and we have the right to use the assets that we lawfully own. Mr. Hill is going to take that from a property right and make that into some sort of anytime a person with significant wealth
what you're
can
doing
void
you're making,
the property right by simply paying damages.
You're making a First Amendment right out of any time anyone infringes on someone's copyright. I've never heard that theory of infringement advanced. I mean, I'm not a specialist in this area, but it seems a little strange. I've never heard of it, and I don't think this was argued to the district court.
It's in Judge Kugler's opinion, Your Honor. Specifically makes reference to TD Bank's First Amendment right.
But we know that can't be from eBay, right? I mean, this is the point that Amicus was making in its brief, that your argument really does ultimately say that any infringement if the copyright holder doesn't want the work to be out, then any infringing uses of it would be irreparable harm, would warrant injunctive relief, and eBay says not so.
But there was more than just, Judge Kugler found on the facts that Mr. Hill, somebody who was not a stranger to Commerce Bank's property rights, somebody who previously violated Commerce Bank's property rights and copyrights, Vernon Hill, who was a person who clearly took language verbatim from TD Bank's bank of property, if you will. And that person, when you balance all those factors together, together with the fact that he didn't, the district court did not initially grant injunctive relief.
All of those harms that you just mentioned, all of those harms can be calculated in monetary ways. And you sit, I don't know, I can't see why your harm is irreparable if, in fact, it can be calculated.
Respectfully, Judge, they can't be calculated if somebody can manipulate the circumstances, somebody who's extremely wealthy.
Means.
Well, like, for example, normally if a book garners $5 a copy when it's sold and 100 copies are sold, you would have $500. But if Mr. Hill...
About manipulating the figures?
If Mr. Hill simply buys the books himself and sells them without a profit, he only has an expense and not a profit.
That's what statutory damages are for.
There are no statutory damages in this case.
That's because you waived them.
We did, without a doubt.
So a party cannot get on the availability of damages, as we're considering eBay factors, simply by waiving them in the district court, can they?
They can't get around them simply because of that, but we have an alternative basis for the damages. We have a First Amendment right, and we have the right to use our property as we see fit. We have a repeat offender of copyright violations.
How is this right not to use the copyright, if the copyright holder doesn't want to, which is what you're saying is the irreparable harm here, how is that different than the right to exclude that the Supreme Court said is not sufficient to justify an injunction in eBay?
Well, in this case here, specifically, what we're not excluding Mr. Hill from telling his story. Mr. Hill can tell a story. Mr. Hill has told his story. Mr. Hill was even able to revise his story to create, at least on the Kindle version, a non-offending 2016 version of the book. This is not a book ban.
That may go to balance of harms, but the question is, what is the irreparable harm to your client other than what seems the equal to equate to the right to exclude, which is not enough for injunctive relief?
We have a property right for which we have a First Amendment interest. And that in and of itself
just
cannot,
the property right? That's just because you have a right?
No.
I mean, is there a
negative? We have a proper...
Is there a negative impact at all on your business as a result of this book?
As a result of the book hasn't...
If it were to be made public.
Well, we've had the book enjoined, so...
Well, I understand that, but is there any impact on TD Bank itself if the book is made public?
It has also a broader right beyond just TD Bank. It's whether or not there's an interest in a copyright that can be made. As to TD Bank itself...
We are balancing harms to some extent.
True.
I'm going to see what the harm is to TD Bank if the book is made public.
TD Bank purchased the property in 2007.
And that too.
TD Bank makes a decision on what of the purchased property it uses.
There's no reputational harm.
There's been no calculation to date of any reputational harm. The harm...
Or economic hardship.
There's economic hardship in trying to continue to protect its rights in its properties. Paying my fees and co-counsel's fee.
All right.
Counsel, do you agree on the public interest eBay factor? Do you agree with Amicus's point that the interest in dissemination of ideas, particularly where the alleged infringing use is bound up with substantial non-infringing use, that should be part of the public interest equation.
That's not the issue here. As a general principle, I agree with it, but to the point of whether or not it's applicable here, the answer is no. Mr. Hill is able to publish his story.
But it was public interest in a work.
But Mr. Hill is able to and has exhibited his ability to transform the 2012 version of the book into a non-offending version of the book.
About opening it up to the entire public.
That he will be able to do that if he simply certifies.
No, he's not talking about a further revision. He's talking about his current book.
No, Judge, maybe I wasn't clear. It's my fault, Judge. The 2012 version of the book was enjoined. That order of Judge Kugler on June 14th, 2016, in the following the entry of that order, Vernon Hill rewrote the book, and has had it published. We have only been able to obtain one version of it, the 2016 Kindle version, and we do not object to that.
It's not the one that's subject to this order, is it?
Correct. We only object to the version that's subject to the 2012 order. So Mr. Hill has exhibited in the balance of harms his ability to rewrite his book. He has exhibited the ability to at least get it on Kindle.
Now you're getting away from the issue, which is public interest in a public work,
but
Cross is asking you.
What that means, Judge, is that the 2016 version is able to be disseminated to the public.
But he's also seeking to continue distribution of the 2012 version.
And that version has been found to violate the copyright laws.
And we're back to the question of whether the injury at issue qualifies for injunctive relief.
And we believe it does, and that Judge Kugler's ruling is correct in that regard, and specifically that the other issue is that Judge Kugler's ruling was entitled to respect, which it was not given.
There's an interesting case. You're probably familiar with it out of the Second Circuit, Enters versus Random, where the Second Circuit declined a preliminary injunction of a Howard Hughes biography because the injunction deprived the public of an opportunity to become acquainted with the life of a person endowed with extraordinary talents. I don't know if Vernon Hill is endowed with extraordinary talents, but he seems to have extraordinary insight into how a bank operates. Why isn't that in the public interest?
Judge, there is nothing precluding Mr. Hill from continuing to market his 2016 version. It doesn't offend Judge Kugler's order.
Is that book the subject of the injunction?
That book is not the subject of the injunction. What it does is that Mr. Hill has exhibited the ease and ability for which he could rewrite those offending portions, and disseminate that to the public. If he were to simply certify that he was not going to continue to distribute, market otherwise, the 2012 version, this case would be over. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
A few quick points by way of rebuttal. I think that this colloquy has very well demonstrated what this case is really about is not any legitimate interest in the 2007 manuscript, but it's about a vendetta against Mr. Hill and using the 2012 book as a cudgel against him. The documents cited by TD Bank to justify the injunction were articles in which Mr. Hill was interviewed and he was referenced as the author of the book. That is what was used to justify the injunction. Mr. Hill using his First Amendment speech. If anybody has a balance of hardships, it's Mr. Hill who has hanging over his head the sword of Damocles, this injunction on the 2012 book that is used every time he is publicly quoted, including in a Financial Times article that reported that he had given the reporter a copy of the 2016 book and it led to accusations that he had violated the injunction against the 2012 book. The fact that injunction against the 2012 book still out there creates a real and concrete interest in Mr. Hill.
Well, they've just pointed out that the injunction was entered because he continued talking about it, marketing it, and selling it, even after the district court had made a finding that it was infringing. And to the extent that the district court opted for injunctive relief in part against the backdrop of that continued distribution of it, notwithstanding the court's finding of infringement, why wouldn't that be appropriate as a conclusion by the district court that nothing short of an injunction was warranted in those circumstances?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not a correct characterization of the record. Mr. Hill, first of all, is not in the business of selling the book. That is, you know, the publisher sells it, third parties sell it. They're not parties before the court. The fact that the book is out there publicly is not within his control.
Those were his interviews.
Yes, he gave interviews. Yes, that's core First Amendment speech, that he gave interviews and people referred to him as the author of the book in Stephen Moore's article in the Wall Street Journal or other, public speaking engagements where he was invited and he came and spoke about it. But that should not be considered infringing conduct. Infringing conduct would be if he was still taking the words that they say they own and putting them in fixed form and distributing them. They don't have a record of that. The closest they have is one document which says at an event that he spoke, copies of the book were given out. But even that is a pretty vague and thin reed on which to hang this entire injunction. Moreover, the jeopardy is really further demonstrated by the fact that he gives out a copy of the 2016 book and they still accuse him of infringing the 2012 book. And yes, the 2012 book is available on Amazon, and if that is infringing conduct, Mr. Hill is still in jeopardy because he has no control over Amazon or any other bookseller that might be selling the book. That's exactly why the public interest supports dissemination of books, especially books like this that are at least 84% conceded non-infringing. My second point would be that Mr. Tambusi has it exactly backwards. The law does not require a writing to preserve Mr. Hill's rights in his work. TD Bank concedes he was the co-author. They repeatedly concede he was the co-author of the book. The only issue is whether he's the owner. As a matter of black letter law, if you are the author, the rights arise in you ab initio and can only be taken away from you under one of two circumstances, work made for hire or an assignment. And respectfully, Mr. Tambusi stood here and he represented that the request for admission that the court cited in its letter this past week was just something for summary judgment. It wasn't. It was a request for admission. That is a binding admission for the life of the court. There, it just so happens there were also material statements of undisputed fact where they confirmed what they said in the request for admission. And there was also deposition testimony where Mr. Fisher, the TD Bank's 30B6 witness, confirmed his view that the guarantee was designed to basically tell the publisher, yes, I'll make sure the book will happen.
But whether Appley has agreed to that or failed to raise it on appeal, to the extent that we conclude we have to address ownership as a threshold issue for the injunction, we could affirm that on any ground, including assignment, right?
If there was an assignment that met the standard of 17 U.S.C. 204A, this guarantee just does not do that. It doesn't say, I assign to you or to anybody else. And all the cites to traditional New York surety guarantee law don't change the fact that the fundamental statute of frauds written into the Copyright Act of 204 are designed to make sure that a writing that is clear, that expresses an intent to assign and alienate a right, is signed by the author, and this guarantee doesn't.
It has to be signed by the author. It doesn't have to be signed by the recipient of the transfer, right? It doesn't have to be signed by the assignee.
The only reason the court would need to worry about who's whether the other party signed it is if the court wanted to entertain TD Bank's theory that it was an integrated contract, that somehow by putting what's in the portfolio agreement with the guarantee, you created a binding agreement. I respectfully, even under those circumstances, there's no clear statement that Mr. Hill was transferring, assigning his rights under the agreement. But that's the only reason that the requirement that the donee comes into it. But there's no need for this court to delve into the minutiae of New York surety and guarantee law, because the Copyright Act creates a clear statute of frauds that requires a clear statement of the transfer of the right.
But why doesn't this take us to, why isn't this just black letter Nimmer saying a failed attempt at a designating something a work for hire can constitute an assignment, that's what it really is. And we have here an explicit attempt to designate something as a work for hire, as well as some other statements that seem consistent with the notion that the bank is the exclusive holder of copyright.
Respectfully, that's not what Nimmer says. I think Your Honor is referring to Nimmer, I think it's B1, B2, that was cited in the letter that was sent to us last week. That section is labeled the effects of the work for hire designation, and it cites back to, and you know, the first section of the work for hire, section 5013A, which goes into the difference between what happens if it's an assignment versus if it's a work for hire. Under the old Copyright Act pre-1976, there were differences in the renewal requirements. After the Sonny Bono Term Extension Act in 1998, Congress gave a right to revert to if it was an assignment, if an author assigned away the rights, Congress created a right to get the rights back. It was part of the quid pro quo. We are extending the life of copyright, and for those of you who have already signed your rights under the copyright and maybe didn't have the right market incentives at the time, we're going to give you the right to get the copyright back. It's litigated now in the context of superhero movies, because the comic book creators that created a lot of these properties decades ago are now finding they have an incentive in exercising this right. And so the section of Nimmer cited is just saying it makes a difference whether it's a work made for hire or an assignment. It is not saying an ineffective assignment can create a work made for hire.
Assuming that they own the work, what is your comment concerning their position that in order to prove irreparable harm, that you're violating their First Amendment right to keep the work to themselves and to sit on it, in effect, or to do with it what they want to do and not what you want or anyone else wants to do?
Respectfully, there's absolutely nothing in the record about why a corporation would need to keep this hidden.
Well, forget. They say they have a First Amendment right. You know, whatever it is, that's a First Amendment right.
It's a post hoc justification. They just don't want Mr. Hill to be able to tell his story, and they want a cudgel to hammer him with. That is what's really going on here. If they had offered some kind of shred of evidentiary basis to say, I will be harmed because I need to keep this private, maybe they would have that argument. I could see that in the case of an individual author who has personal self-esteem maybe tied into a particular work. But this is a corporation. It's a bank. It was something they were not using at all. They're just using it for their vendetta against Mr. Hill.
You made this argument to the district court. I assume that there was a joint ownership issue. And I would guess that the district court at that point referenced the agreement as well as the guarantee and determine that Mr. Hill had in fact transferred all of his rights to Commerce, those rights were acquired by TD Bank. Is that the way it went?
Yes. As Mr. Tambusi said, the district court resolved numerous issues of fact in favor of TD Bank, the moving party, when they should not.
It may not have been an issue of fact if there were signed documents. Then it's not necessarily an issue of fact, is it?
When they're ambiguous, it is.
Counsel, Nimmer in that section is saying that an agreement between employer and employee that is not, in fact, prepared within the scope of employment being deemed works for hire will not itself convert such works into the for hire category. And then it says such an agreement may be regarded as the equivalent of a simple transfer of copyright from the employee to the employer. Why isn't that Nimmer pointing out that if a failed attempt to designate something as a work for hire can in fact be an assignment?
That's not how I read what Nimmer is saying in that section. It does not mean a reference to work made for hire creates a transfer, and it doesn't create an exception to the very clear standards set forth in 17 U.S.C. 204A. No, it simply refers to consequences.
It seems to be identifying one of the one piece of circumstantial evidence you could look to try to glean intent. That is, has the employee designated something as a work for hire, indicating their relinquishment of their own rights?
There may be theoretically a situation where somebody's writing is relevant evidence to the question of whether there was a work made for hire, but Nimmer is not saying you don't apply the equitable agency factors that the Supreme Court said to turn to in CCNV versus Reed into whether a work for hire existed in the first place.
Correct, but we're talking about whether an assignment exists here.
Yeah, so if we're looking at an assignment, that one stray sentence in Nimmer is not saying there is an exception to Section 204A if there's a half-handed reference to a work made for hire. That is not the meaning of that section. That section is about the implications that are created if something is an assignment versus a work made for hire.
We thank counsel for your long and very excellent arguments, and we will take this interesting case under advisement. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor.